have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. These statements are not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure, or prevent any disease. This notice is required by the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
This new Godzilla is unfriendly and is going to destroy your country. There's nothing you can do about it.
Isn't there anything job-related that you should be doing at this particular moment?
Welcome to the Medic Shack with your host, Chuck Hudson, a former combat medic, EMT paramedic, and currently a survival medicine instructor. And Kat Ellis, herbalist, herbal author, and preparedness expert. The Medic Shack is a place to learn alternative emergency medicine, what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. From minor wound care to moderate and complex trauma, providing instruction in herbal medicine, from basic antibiotics, antivirals, all the way up to complex tinctures, decoctions, and compounds. The Medic Shack, teaching you how to bring your health care under your control, no matter whether it's good times or bad. We will show you how to use your landscape to make your own medicine. We will show you how to take disaster, survival, and herbal medicine to the next level. The statements made here have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The statements here are not intended to treat, diagnose, prevent, or cure any disease. This notice is required by the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
Do you live in a major metropolitan center?
No.
Do you live in a remote area?
Neither. I live in it's not suburban, but it's you call it rural, but not majorly rural. We're 30 miles away from the city.
Which city?
Albuquerque.
Okay. Did you make the decision to move where you are, at least in part because of nuclear threats?
Possibly, just because, mainly, a lot of folks don't know it. The city of inside the city limits of Albuquerque, there are three nuclear reactors.
Right.
Okay. In addition to that, we have Sandia National Labs. And then also on west of me, we have Los Alamos National Labs, which are two primary sites. Now, prevailing winds here where I live at, in the little town of Edgewood, New Mexico, are west to east. We have the winds that come, most of our wind comes from the Sandia Mountains, an 11,000 foot mountain range, 20 miles east of me. And you know how mountains work, you know, cool air on the top of the mountain drops down the mountain, displaces the warm air, and we get a constant breeze out here. But one of the reasons Christine and I looked out here, one was distance to work. We had to be within 30 minutes to the schools and a bunch of things. But actually, you are right, Doc. On that little chart there was Albuquerque, because at the time, Albuquerque, and still is a primary nuclear target, because we have Sandia, we have Los Alamos, and we have Kirtland, and all three things. But the westerly winds will blow the radiation on you. Yes.
And I only ask that because Sweet Pea One and I had many considerations when we decided to buy our homestead. And nuclear was one of them. It certainly wasn't the only one of them. But we live about 150 miles downwind of the nearest nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. And we don't live anywhere near primary or tertiary nuclear targets in the event of a war.
Right.
So again, that was not the only consideration. There were many other considerations, such as access to water, low crime, population density. But I'll be perfectly honest with you, the nuclear equation did, at least in part, come into play when we made our decision to move.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I'll say the same thing in us too. Now, the bad thing about that, when we bought our place almost 20 years ago, we didn't have one side sidebar of nuclear history that happened 10 years ago. The waste isolation pilot plant came online.
Right.
And so on two sides of me, US 285, which is about 18 miles northeast and east of me, the waste canisters are transported. Also down Interstate 40, which is about 2 miles to my south. So, you know, we got that little thing. But I will say one thing about the WIP site. The radiation, the drums used, I mean, not the drums, but the transport container used, almost realistically, would take a nuclear device to open, unless you have the key to open them. But it's still, radiation is a primary concern. Now, defense against radiation, like I said, it's time, distance, and shielding. And people laughed at our house because our house is double-sided brick. And we bought it. You know, we saw this house.
That's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Even though it makes our house look a little bit short and fat because of the way the brick is laid in the house, it is a fine protector from anything that might happen 30 miles away in Albuquerque. So I got time, I got distance and shielding. And the time factor is speed of light decay. Gamma radiations, no matter what you're going to do, it's going to hit you, it's going to be gone. You'll never even know it until the secondary effects show up. But time is a big thing in alpha and beta particles. It takes time because they're solid. And so they cannot be accelerated in one to the speed of light. Einstein says so far that cannot happen. But they do move fairly quickly, and then they'll be caught in the wind. And in another matter of shielding is I got an 11,000-foot mountain in between me and Albuquerque. So, you know, you got that. But radiation, though, is a serious object here. We have to be concerned about it. We don't have to panic about it, but we do have to know how to take care of it. So going back
to... if I may, the alpha and beta particles, and I hear all kinds of confusion regarding this in survival literature. So if you would be kind enough to bear with me, Chuck, sure. I'd just like to explain some of the differences, okay, and how these terms are misused. Like I said, a beta particle, the actual particle itself, is you might think of it as a loose electron. We all know what an atom looks like. You've got a nucleus and these electrons spinning around it. A alpha particle is a helium nucleus. And as Chuck said earlier, alphas are the least penetrating and betas are somewhat more penetrating. And, of course, gamma photons are by far the most penetrating. But it's not the individual electron or the individual helium nucleus that really represents much of a threat. The problem with, and let's use the term more appropriately, beta and alpha emitters. Now, earlier in the program, Chuck had mentioned, and we saw this, what was that movie? I think it was with Meryl Streep about the nuclear fuel processing plant.
Yes. Jack Lemmon was in it, and was it the – oh, no, I don't know what you're talking about.
No, it was Silkwood. If you remember in Silkwood, they had a they had a scene where an elderly woman had been accidentally contaminated, and they showed her being scrubbed down in one of the decontamination rooms. Do you remember that?
Yes, sir.
And that was exactly the sort of scenario you were bringing up earlier.
Uh-huh.
Okay. If you have the alpha and beta emitters, and I'm talking about microscopic bits of particulate, dust size, as it were, you might think of these things as miniature light bulbs constantly giving off rays of energy, be they electrons or helium nucleuses. Most of that can be washed off of you. If you've ever heard the term beta burns, that comes from people being externally contaminated with beta. Frequently it happens when you've got wet or sweaty skin and fallout dust falls on you and stays on your skin. And it creates a weeping-type burn on your skin. And that's bad, but it's really not that dangerous.
Correct.
the danger occurs when you inhale or ingest these tiny particles, okay? And many of the isotopes are attracted to certain types of tissue. Some are attracted to bone. Some are attracted to lung muscle. We mentioned earlier that iodine is attracted to the thyroid gland. Some aren't attracted to anything. They just travel around the body and perhaps will lodge in a bit of tissue. Now, the problem is when that nucleide, and I'm not talking about an individual atom. I'm talking about a small particle, which may contain millions or trillions of atoms, of individual atoms. When that gets jammed into a body part, for instance, a calcium mimicker might become part of your bone. That emitter constantly irradiates the surrounding cells. Think of it as a little reactor stuck in your body. And it constantly irradiates all of that living tissue immediately surrounding that particle. And that is what causes the tumors. We mentioned tritium earlier. Well, tritium is a low-energy isotope, and it's really not generally attracted to any specific part of the body. Much like water, it tends to flow in and out of the body. So the tritium biological half-life, and by biological half-life, I don't mean the half-life of the isotope. I mean the amount of time it spends in the body. It is usually only around 10 or 11 days, at which point roughly half of it is excreted from the body, and it's no longer much of a problem. And because it's been moving throughout the body the whole time, it hasn't been sitting there energizing only one given group of cells. But if you have radioactive calcium, cobalt, that sort of thing, and it lodges in part of your body, you are almost certainly going to develop a tumor somewhere down the road. That makes sense, Chuck?
Yes, sir, it does. You know, and radiation poisoning is bad. In fact, in 17 years I've been in Heart Hospital, I have seen, not from our lab, but I've seen come in from other places, two cases of X-ray radiation burns due to extremely long fluoroscopy times on extremely large patients. And the thing about it is, the bigger the patient, the more what we call scatter you're going to get off of it. But back to the original topic, though, you know, radiation is something to worry about. We need to be concerned about it. I don't think we need to fret overly about it. The Fukushima reactor in Japan, I mean, yes, it's still leaking a lot of various isotopes into the ocean. But one of the advantages of having an ocean like the Pacific Ocean, you get dilution. And since most of these elements are heavier than water, they will eventually go to the ocean floor and not pose an immediate hazard to people.
Now, Chuck, I hate to interrupt you, but I see that we're at 8:56 right now. Yeah. Are we going to shut her down at 9 o'clock, or are we
can go a little bit. We can go a little bit over because nobody follows us. We can kind of finish the conversation.
Okay, fine.
I don't stay up too much later because, you know, I got my mother just came to town and for Jacob's graduation. But like I say, Fukushima is a bad mess. I mean, it's the second worst nuclear accident in the world. The first that we all know about is Chernobyl. And that one there, if you go to Chernobyl now, the city is deserted. The city is gone. They evacuated who survived. And it's a harsh thing to say, but the Russians are, and even today, are very cavalier with their people. A lot of people, when I was sent to Leningrad, I was what we call TDY in Germany at the time. I was a battalion NBC NCO. For 1st Battalion, 15th Infantry. And I was senior NCO that was available, and myself and a young captain and another lieutenant, we got sent to Leningrad to monitor the radiation plume as it crossed Russia into Finland. And we stayed at the consulate. And we got to do one flyover of the reactor at about 150 meters. Actually, two flyovers. We did one in the daytime. which actually that one scared me worse than the one at night. The night
how
one.
How long after the accident was that?
2 weeks. 2 weeks after
that
the accident.
That was an incredibly dangerous flight, my friend.
Oh, I know it was, but and I think I paid for it. But the aircraft were shielded. They were shielded, military helicopters, and they did have they lined the bottom of the helicopter with lead sheets. So I mean, that's why we didn't have we had a full fuel load and not many people on it, because the bird was very heavy, and we were at about 100-150 meters, about 300 feet above the reactor, and we did two quick flights over it. One was in the daytime, and that one scared me worse than a nighttime flight, because a nighttime flight you could see the cesium glow of the reactor, of the leaking reactor. But the daytime one is one that scared me, because you'd see Russian soldiers, Russian citizens, wearing just basically what we call a bunny suit, a little
right.
coverall and a little surgical mask, going in and out of that reactor area, moving equipment, moving stuff out. Every one of those people, I bet, died. I mean, the area was... Oh, thanks, Ryan. I got coffee finally. it was a horrible accident, and it killed the entire area for about 20 years. Now, you do overflights of that area. Yes, the radiation level is still high in localized areas and in a plume going from a southeast to a northwest pattern. There's a plume off the reactor that is still extremely radioactive, but you go back in there. Nature took over. The trees are back. The animals are back. You don't have three-headed fish or three-eyed fish or two-headed deer. It comes back. There you're talking about the time thing. The planet kind of took care of, and it's been burying it slowly.
During our pre-show, you and I discussed my hypothesis regarding tumors.
Right.
Do you think that's worthwhile going over with the audience?
It's a little bit, you know, because, I mean, it's one of the concerns we could have. I mean, we could run into. It's not like in the top 10, but it's a good point to point out to people that actually live in the vicinity of nuclear plants. And, oh, by the way, the nearest nuclear power plant to me is Palo Verde, Arizona, which is on the Arizona-California border, which is probably one of the it's a good place to put a reactor because it's nowhere near people, but it's also on a branch, one of the branch faults off to San Andreas. We'll just leave that alone. All right, Doc, go ahead, sir.
Well, I have a hypothesis, and again, I need to stress to the audience that, I'm not a physician. I am not a physicist. My claim to fame when it comes to things nuclear is that I am an award-winning journalist who has studied and written about nuclear issues for quite a long time. And I have come up with my own hypothesis, and not only as I think, do I think the hypothesis is valid, but I think the reasons why what I'm about to explain is not done will become self-evident after my explanation. It is my belief, well, let me backtrack a moment and point out that prior to the early part of the 20th century, cancer was a virtually unknown disease. Now, the naysayers can, with some justification, say, well, medical technology was so primitive, they couldn't easily diagnose cancer and other diseases. And there is some truth to that, but it's not a complete truth. Because if you go back to the age of Hippocrates and early Greek and Roman physicians, they did know what cancer was. They would see it from time to time, though it was very rare. And it was considered to be extremely rare up through the 19th century. We didn't have an explosion of cancer until the 20th century. And this goes back to what I'd pointed out earlier about the massive explosion of uranium mining and radium extraction. And then cancer seemed to explode. Now, here's my hypothesis, and no hospitals do this, believe it or not. I believe that if every tumor that was excised from a patient, whether they survived or passed, if they actually screened every tumor for radionuclides, they would find the genesis of that tumor in radioactive contamination. There would be a radionuclide, or more likely many radionuclides, at the center of that tumor. And it's technology which is actually quite easily utilized, though it's somewhat expensive. And you would think that would be the greatest cancer-detecting technology available, and yet no one does it.
Nope.
So the question is, why? Well, I think the answer is self-evident. They don't want the knowledge of that causality to become public.
It's exactly right. You know, and it's...
Chuck, you said you really haven't thought about that.
No, I haven't.
In our pre-show. But, I mean, does it make more sense to you now?
It does. You know, I was actually, while you were talking about that earlier, I was actually on the Internet looking up stuff, and I was looking at cancer rates in the United States from 1850 to 1910, and it was generally a 1 per 10,000 incidence. I mean, I was looking at all cancers, and cancer has been part of our history because of one major reason, even prior to the industrial age, is because the Earth enjoys a very high, as planets go, background radiation.
And that's true.
You know, and a few of us, and it's saved our lives because of we are able to survive, you know, the solar storms that hit the planet because we have a background radiation. But it's also a trade-off in incidence of cancers. Now you look at cancers from, say, 1910 to 1980, and cancer population is 1 to about 5,000 people, which is a huge increase. That's
correct.
A doubling increase there. And today, it is even higher. And if you strap your tinfoil hat on really tight with some duct tape, you can look at the electromagnetic radiation that we continually emit. Our phones, even not so much radio waves because it's a different frequency, but our phones, our communication system of this age is all microwave, which is a form of gamma radiation. You know, it's just another form of it, just gamma radiation. We call it ionizing radiation. And those of you that have a ham radio license, or remember the old days of CB, and used to put a good pair of shoes on your CB radio, which is a linear amplifier, and you'd get some idiot to grab hold of your antenna while you keyed the mic, and you'd give them a radiation burn. You know, nowadays we know better than that, or at least hope some of us do, but, you know, the amount of radiation that we emit into the environment is hundredfold more than it was a century ago.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, I don't know, you're a medical professional. You doubtlessly have a better take on this than I do. But and I have a cell phone. I am not a technological troglodyte. But I find that I rarely carry my cell phone in my pocket. I tend to keep it on my desk and use it more as an answering machine than a personal communication device. And if I am traveling in a vehicle, I tend to put it in the console away from my body, not next to my genitals, not in my jacket pocket next to my heart and lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And I will, you know, I'll answer the phone, but only when someone calls me. I don't keep this thing in intimate contact with my body.
Yeah, and a modern-day smartphone emits a lot more radiation than the analog cell phones that we had 15 years ago.
But do you agree that that's a good policy or not?
That's a good policy because we don't understand, and especially with children. Our kids have so much radiation, and what I've done with my boys, it cost me a little bit of money, but they keep the phone on the belt or in their back pocket, you know, which is a good amount of shielding because you have a whole bunch of butt to go through. And it is a fairly low-powered radiation, but I have them do more of their talking with a Bluetooth device.
Right.
Because they don't have the main radiation emitter clamped to the side of their head. I mean, I think it's good policy. I do follow my own advice like that most of the time. But, you know, we've become conditioned. We've become connected to the net. And if we're not connected to the net, we have withdrawal symptoms. We did a little study on stuff like that. But protection of radiation is, the Corvette Museum in Bowling Green, Kentucky. That is a good topic right there. where that museum sucked up some very expensive Corvettes from undetected limestone sinkholes.
Well, Chuck, do you have a pretty good handle on Geiger counters and scintillators and various radiation detectors?
Yes.
I did a story some years ago. It made me very unpopular with the local municipal airport authorities. But I had found four or five derelict old passenger planes parked, abandoned and parked at the end of one of the runways. And I don't remember what they were now. I've got the story in my files, but there were something like old Constellations, you know, four-engine, radial-engine, propeller-driven airliners.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, this is going back probably 25, 30 years, but I knew that virtually all of those early aircraft, and I'm going back even further than that, back to World War I, had radium-illuminated instruments in their cockpit. So I took one of my Ludlum Geiger counters with a very sensitive pancake probe. You know what those are, don't
right.
you?
Mm-hmm.
And surreptitiously gained access to the airport. When I say surreptitiously, it's not like I was doing any James Bond commando raid, climbing fences with wire cutters. I just found a remote gate that was opened and walked in. And, you know, my thinking being the worst anyone is going to do is tell me to leave. But it was at such a remote part of the airport, nobody even showed up. And as I walked towards those Constellations, you know, I got within 9 or 10 feet of those cockpits. And that Ludlum Geiger counter really started to give me heavy returns. So I got into the plane because, you know, most of them had the doors open and the stairs down, and walked into the cockpits. And, of course, you know, these were old planes, probably from the early 50s. But as you can imagine, even an early 50s cockpit is a very complex-looking
right.
technological installation. There were literally scores of instruments. Some I could tell what they were. False horizons and altimeters and such, oil pressure gauges. Some I had no clue what they were. I'm not a pilot. But you would not believe how hot it was. I mean, radiologically hot in that cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to wonder how many pilots spent how many tens of thousands of hours in each of those cockpits flying that plane. Now, the other thing that immediately came to mind was that you've flown an old propeller-driven aircraft before, haven't you?
Yep, C-130s, many, many, many miles. And I got to fly in a Connie once.
Well, unlike most modern jet aircraft, they vibrate like hell.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Even a C-130, which is actually a prop jet, not a radial engine,
right.
true propeller. I mean, they vibrate.
Oh,
okay?
Yeah.
And so can you imagine further? The constant vibration against these instruments in the cockpit, how many minute particles of this radium illumination paint were constantly vibrating off of the dial faces?
Yep.
Right?
And inhaling that stuff?
Inhaling it from the cabin crew, from the stewardesses, and from the passengers. So then, this is part of my work as a journalist, I looked into these planes a little further and what the disposition was. And it turned out that the airport authority had put a bid out to scrap companies to haul them away and break them up. And there was absolutely no requirement for radiological protection in this contract. And what I realized that they were going to send a bunch of minimum wage guys out there with ball peen hammers, okay, and crowbars to break this stuff up. And I could see that you're probably looking at groups of men who 10, 20, 30 years down the road were going to wind up with cancers for which no one had any clue as to the causation. And that's when I started to come to my hypothesis that there's got to be a tremendous number of cancer victims in this country that were inadvertently exposed to radionuclides, had no clue, never remembered the episode, and that's what killed them.
Huh. That's a good thing to dig into further in that. That is.
So having done that story, and I mean, I'm not claiming that, you know, I saved the world. Hopefully I saved a few human beings who otherwise would have been unaware of it. But because of the local exposure that story generated, the U.S. Air Force came out with complete NBC protection, and they removed the radium-bearing instrument panels before the rest of the planes were allowed to be salvaged.
Huh.
But that was one tiny example, Chuck. But imagine how many things have gone on like that over the decades and the generations since radiation became such a perversive part of our environment.
Yep, I can just imagine. So last bit I want to get into here, since we're going over a little bit here, which is okay since nobody follows us, is decontamination. So external decontamination is actually pretty easy. Lots and lots and lots of flowing water and a very active soap. The reason why is soap breaks the surface tension of the water and allows things to be lifted and flush. You know, you've seen Dawn detergent is a good example of that. You do not want to scrub the person and cause injury to the skin. You are just making more vectors for the radiation. Now, what about internal radiation? That one is more difficult. And one of the methods that was used in the military back in the 80s and up into the 90s was one of two. One was you'd start massive IVs on the people and almost fluid overload them with fluid and then give them a diuretic, flushing the body out. It's one of the ways that you get rid of alpha particles. A more enjoyable and almost an effective method is to drink as much low alcohol beer as you can. It sounds goofy, but what it is, basically, you are just flushing the cells of your body with more and more fluid, and you're just doing a fluid exchange and trying to get it out. And it's one of the methods that we used to use in the military back in the 80s of idiots that, hey, this is a W-46 nuclear artillery shell. Can we open it? Infantrymen. Seriously, nothing like that ever happened, but it's just the type of things that you could. A good example is a kid.
Without asking you to compromise any of your classified background, are you aware of any episodes like that ever happening with idiots who tried to open up a nuclear weapon?
None that I know about.
Okay.
None that I know about. We'll just leave it at that point right there. Now, I tell you one thing here of a kid that tried to commit suicide with an M8A1 chemical alarm. What he did was the M8 alarm, the original M8, was just a regular bypass detector. It just changed density, and it could tell you if it had, and it had little minor algorithms that could tell you different chemicals. The M8A1 and the A2 surge alarm, they had an americium core in them. And so your chemical agents went through the americium, and it's the same way a smoke detector works. Well, this kid saw an alarm, and he was tired of the arm, and he wanted out. So he broke open the detector cell on the M8, grabbed out probably about the size of a grain of rice, if even that, piece of americium, and ate it.
Oh, good Lord.
I'm not kidding you, Doc. This kid did that. He wanted out that bad that he got out. Let me tell you, sir, they kicked him right out after they flushed this poor kid to no end to get rid of the – I mean, this poor kid, he was miserable after the military doctors got through with him and they discovered that he ate a piece of americium. And americium is a very hot isotope.
Oh, yeah. Someone in chat, I didn't correct them. I don't remember who it was. I just read several lines up. Someone had said that americium was either not very hot or not very dangerous. But, in fact, americium is extremely dangerous.
Yep, it is. It's a very dangerous isotope. In fact, americium has caused more nuclear accidents than plutonium. Because americium, to get critical mass of plutonium, you need, 3 kilograms. And then you need a neutronator, or you need to have like 10 or 12 kilograms at one point and compress it. But, you know, it takes quite a bit. Americium, on the other hand, you need in a matter of tens of ounces for critical mass. It is a very hot isotope, and it's used in your, if you got a fire, a smoke detector in your house, you have americium.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost scandalous the number of them that are thrown away into landfills.
Yep. I'd see. Kit's got a question. When washing like that, do you want to put the soap on before the water like you do to get oil off skin? Generally, the idea is when you go through nuclear decontamination is flushed water first. They strip you down. And unfortunately, though, men and women, you get shaved because hair will harbor particles of radiation. Men already have a close crop haircut in the military. Women don't. But after decontamination, both do. Then you go into not a high pressure, but kind of like just a low, a medium low pressure shower, and it is with warm water, not hot water, not cold water. Reason why: hot water causes your pores to open, more access for contaminants to get in, and cold water will cause you to literally, you won't wash well. It's just the way it is on that. You know, you just want warm water because it's comfortable. You want to put and you want to be comfortable. Flush with water, then a lot of soap, high foaming soap. We used to use dishwashing detergent in the military because it will foam even in the hardest of water. Where your standard lye based soaps, you know, bar soaps, if you got really hard water, they don't foam up that well. Then they would go through a couple more rinses. They do that at probably about two times. And then you'd run over every square millimeter with a Geiger counter. Well, actually more like a pancake probe on it instead of the tube, the Rankine probe.
Correct.
And you would go through and you would, you know, just detect them. And if you had anything over, what was it? I think it was 12% over background radiation, they went back in. And you kept doing that to go through. Now, then they would go through. And they would, we had a, I don't know what method they used today, but it was a type of, you went into a, they put you into a really dark room and you had to stand next to a photographic plate. And it's kind of like the body scanners of today, except it was exact opposite. You were exposing the plate, not the machine exposing you. And
right.
The plate was developed and they would look for hot spots where the plate was fogged by radiation. Then they would give you, you would get a couple of big bore IVs in you, and they would calculate the maximum fluid you could have for your sex, your size, your age, your what we call stroke volume of your heart. They would do an echocardiogram on you, and then you would get massive amounts of fluid and a diuretic at the same time. And we had a lot of instances of cardiac arrest because of that. The reason why is diuretics. Lasix is the most common one. Besides pulling water off your body, it pulls your electrolytes out. Your heart runs on potassium, chloride, and sodium. And when you lose those electrolytes, well, as Doc found out, electrolyte depletion can be painful.
Oh, yeah. Now, you know, I have a suggestion. I know we're getting low on time.
Well,
you are certainly more qualified to address this than I am, but in future, if you would like me to sit in.
Oh, hell yeah, anytime.
If only for comic relief, I will be happy to contribute what I
don't
what
have. I have a lot of background and physical knowledge of it, but I don't have a good portion of the theoretical knowledge. I have enough that got me through advanced NCO course for being a nuclear weapons defense.
Well, here's what I was going to suggest, Chuck. As I'm sure you realize, most of our audience is of, shall we say, a certain age. I am 59. I could be contaminated tomorrow at a low level, and I would probably die of other causes before I die
exactly.
of radiation-induced sickness.
Exactly.
But I have a 5-year-old granddaughter, and of course I'm sure most of us have young people in our family. And it would probably be more advantageous for us to do another show of how to better protect the little ones.
Right. And see, that's actually a good one because we actually Kat and I have got some pediatric shows planned, and that would be a really good one. Now, Charlie Brown says, in the aftermath of an EMP, imagine all those nuke plants and rod pools burning.
That is a big problem.
Yeah, it'd be a big problem, but it's actually not a realistic problem. The reason why is when the plants were built, the original and the problem, one of the problems is our plants were built by the World War II generation. So, but the good thing about them being built by that generation, they were built very well. The plants built in the 1970s and the 1980s were not built as well as the older reactors of the 40s and 50s. That being said, though, even the modern nuclear reactors, from what I know about them, from talking to a friend of mine that works at Palo Verde, and what he could tell me about them, there are, besides electrical backups to what's called scram the reactor, they're mechanical too. So an EMP, though, would fry the electrical system of, I don't even know if it would fry a nuclear reactor because they're pretty well shielded, but even if it did, there's still the mechanical backups.
I'm not worried about scramming the reactor. That is the least of my concern.
Right.
The problem is maintaining the throughput of cooling water.
There you go.
Because as you scram the reactor, that does not instantly eliminate the heat.
Nope. It's still hot in there.
Decay heat, which occurs for a year or two. And that decay heat, at least in the early stages, is perfectly capable of melting those rods.
Yes, it is. It's the same method that the RTGs, the radioisotope thermal generators, used on, like, the Cassini spacecraft.
Right.
People thought that is an actual nuclear reactor on a spacecraft, and it's not. It's actually plutonium-230, the non-weapons-grade plutonium.
No, I'm familiar with what you're talking about.
But, Palo Verde is one of those reactors that is actually pretty well designed. And the reason why I say that, every other reactor in the United States is, one, built near a population center, and two, built near a source of water to cool the reactor and to generate steam for the turbines. Palo Verde is located next to a dry river out in the middle of the desert. Literally, if you've ever driven to Palo Verde, you have to have a purpose because it is out in the middle of nowhere. Palo Verde, how it cools the reactor, since it doesn't have a flowing river, they use the waste sewer water from Phoenix, Mesa, Scottsdale, Tucson, and a few other cities. And that wastewater, it goes to a waste treatment plant on site with Palo Verde that treats the water. And then that water is what's used in a closed-loop system to cool the reactor and to generate steam for the turbines. It's a pretty smart hey, Tinker, how you doing, sir? It's a pretty smart little system over there. But, yeah, we definitely, Doc, need to come in here and get a show on the after effects of radiation on different age groups, especially kids. Because
Before I go, there's one thing that I would like to share, and by all means – give us your input. There is a canard, a half-truth, as it were, that has been going around the nuclear industry for many decades. And this has been part of, the Obama administration's efforts to eliminate coal-fired plants in the United States. And that is the old saw that coal-fired plants emit more radiation than nuclear plants do. I'm sure you've heard that, haven't
right.
you? Okay. And here's what people really need to understand. Who was it? Mark Twain, who said there's lies, damned lies, and statistics?
Uh-huh.
It is true that coal-fired plants do emit rather substantial amounts of radiation into the atmosphere. And here's what they emit primarily. They emit uranium
mm-hmm.
and related uranium daughters, uranium isotopes, including very minute amounts of radium. And I stress that, very minute amounts of radium. But primarily what they emit is uranium and uranium daughter products. And they emit these things because they are natural. They occur in the earth. Just like gold. I'm sure we'd all love to find that we had a gold mine in our backyard. And the fact of the matter is that in microscopic quantities, there's gold in virtually everyone's backyard, irrespective of where they live. The problem is finding gold in economically recoverable amounts.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there is not gold. Gold is all over the place, but very rarely is it found in economically recoverable or substantial amounts. Now, the uranium products and uranium daughter products that are emitted coal smoke are, A, not very radioactive. The most common isotope of uranium is what's known as uranium-238. And it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. The longer the half-life of an isotope, the less radioactive it is. So natural uranium, yes, it's radioactive, but it is only considered to be, and I quote directly from the textbooks, weakly radioactive. So A, there is not very much of it. And B, it is weakly radioactive, whereas many of the isotopes released from nuclear power plants have much shorter half-lives and are much more intensely radioactive. So just remember that the next time you hear some environmentalist wacko type or some leftist screaming that coal plants deposit more radiation into the atmosphere than nuclear power plants. That part, as far as it goes, is probably true. But what they do deposit is very weakly radioactive and not much of a threat compared to what your nuclear power plants can release.
Yeah, they tried that topic with it's being shut down as we speak, though. But when a few years ago, when they tried to shut down the Farmington nuclear generation plant, power plant, that's a coal-fired plant up here, they tried to use the radiation scare on it, and they picked the wrong town to do a radiation scare on, is Farmington, New Mexico, because majority of the of the uranium mines in the country are in that area of New Mexico and Arizona. And it's like these old guys said, yeah, right, whatever. They didn't care about it. Manny had a good comment in here, and I actually do not have an answer for it, and I'll have to look it up here. She says, if AMP shuts down the pumps at Palo Verde, no cooling for that plant. Huh. That could be an interesting issue right there. Like I said, we got to get out of here. My wife has poked her head in the office twice asking where I'm at because she's probably tired of hanging around with my mom.
On all of our behalf, thank your wife for her forbearance.
Oh, yes, and thank you folks for spending your Sunday evening with us. Doc, thanks for topping in with me. I really appreciate your insight and input on a subject that I do know a bit about, but I had some gaps in it. Now, one thing, I'm going to throw one picture up here in the chat room before we leave, and it'll be something just to let you know the power of a nuclear device. That picture I just popped in the chat room is a nuclear shadow. That is from Hiroshima. That is a shadow of a person with a cane that was vaporized, but in the milliseconds before they were vaporized by the heat of the burst, it bleached the surrounding concrete.
Right.
And they shielded the concrete for a few milliseconds. And it's just an aftermath. Just kind of remember, even though nuclear is a scary thing, it's a very dangerous thing, it's a very powerful thing. It's actually not on my top 10 things to worry about with what we got going on in the country today. All right, Doc, again, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Chuck, it has been my pleasure.
All right, folks, you have a great night. We'll see everybody next week. Bye.
Good night.
Adams, Mason, Franklin, Gary, Ames, and Washington. Lee and Rutledge, Hancock, Wilson, Wythe. Sherman, Adams, Hall, and Rodney, Penn, and Dickinson.
For the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence and the 37 who signed the Constitution.
And here's to you, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help. these fools that legislate. Rights away, our rights away. We'd like to know why you haven't read all the bills you filed. We'd like for you to read them for yourself. Look around you, all you see are patriotic guys. Stroll around the land, the brave and free go home. And here's to you, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help these fools that legislate. Rights away, our rights away. Hiding all your $1 trillion debt so we don't know. Hide it in your made-up FICA trust fund. It's a little secret just the congressman will know. Worst of all, you pass the debt on to the kids. They think we're fools, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help these fools that legislate. Rights away, our rights away. Ripping up our Constitution every afternoon. Give themselves a raise with no debate. Laughing at founding fathers when they've got to choose. Everything they warned of's coming true. Where have you gone, Ron, Wilson, Reagan? Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Woo, woo, woo. What's that you say, Mr. Jefferson? The giver has left and gone away. And we prayed, wish he stayed.